Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In Haiti, the rescue effort has been called off nearly 2 weeks after an earthquake hit the capital. A man unearthed on Saturday was likely the last person to be pulled alive from the rubble. And now the rebuilding begins. Some are saying that Haiti can now be better and stronger than before. But is that possible?
We need to roll up our sleeves and begin to lay the groundwork for the enormous task ahead. We want to get it done right.
Haitians need shelter now, and the country is the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. What kind of Haiti will rise from the rubble? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 25th, and you just heard the Canadian foreign minister's takeaway that they want to rebuild Haiti right. But mine is, how can you possibly, is that possible? I have doubts.
Well, we're going to explore the details and the challenges in Haiti in just a moment. But first, here are the top stories we're following. The president's first State of the Union address, according to our partners, the New York Times, will include some of the following modest details. The president's going to focus on middle-class families. It's going to have a package that includes tax credits for child care, caps on some student loans. Compared to the president's first-year agenda, the proposals are said to be less than extremely ambitious, but White House advisor David Axelrod tells ABC News there's nothing new in the presidential software.
In Washington, people look for signs, cues for their script to say, here's Obama 2.0. This is the Obama who ran for president.
And as for Republicans, earlier we spoke to Raihan Salam, fellow at the New America Foundation, who told us the GOP has to offer solutions now and not simply oppose the existing Democrat plan.
So it's very easy to focus on opposition. That's something that you see with regard to any party that's an out party. And I think that they're enjoying that. They're taking advantage of it. But it's not something that's going to work forever.
President Obama's first State of the Union address is on Wednesday night.
In Haiti, survivors are streaming out of Port-au-Prince as truckers filling mass graves say 150,000 bodies have been buried so far. Meanwhile, in Montreal this morning, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Haiti's prime minister are among the leaders who are meeting to discuss the long-term reconstruction of Haiti. Speaking last hour, the Canadian prime minister, Stephen Harper, pledged his support to his Haitian counterpart.
We're all looking at the terrible situation in your country The task ahead of you is unimaginable. I say this, Sean Max, as a fellow prime minister. I just can't imagine, but you know that our government is with you.
For the latest, we're joined now by Ed Pilkington, New York correspondent for The Guardian. He just returned from a week in Haiti. Ed, what is happening there now?
Yes, I was there for a week and I got out on Friday. And every day you could see things getting a little bit better, a little bit more food on the streets, signs of people clearing the rubble. But I have to say it was agonizingly slow, that the water was arriving very, very late. Food was scarce. You might have a water truck every 1, 2, or 3 miles apart. And wherever we went, we were surrounded by people begging us for information about where to find food and water. So things are still extremely bad.
Is the news of a mass exodus of Port-au-Prince accurate?
Absolutely. On my final day, we went and found them, and there are hundreds of thousands of people quitting the city. You have to say it's logical. They're getting on buses. They're going back to their homes. Most of these people have come from the countryside in the first place. They're now going home to find food and shelter in their families.
Well, stay with us, Ed. We'll talk with you more about that in just a moment.
In other news, a new audio message from Osama bin Laden. Authorities are attempting to verify it now. It claims responsibility for the Christmas Day bombing attempt in Detroit. Top U.S. commander in Afghanistan says a negotiated peace with the Taliban now is a way to end the war there. And in the Big Easy, the Saints are going to the Super Bowl along with the Indianapolis Colts. The Colts are favored, but the heartstrings are with the New Orleans Saints. Asian and European markets are down. Futures up. The Dow gets underway at 10,172, the S&P opens at 1,091, and the Nasdaq opens at 2,205.
We're going to welcome our new audience in New York. Starting this week, we're on 4 hours every morning on WNYC AM 820. And coming up in just a moment, we're going to be talking about the state of America and the task for Obama. It's been nearly 2 weeks since a 7.0 earthquake in Haiti destroyed much of the infrastructure there, and they're finally calling rescue efforts off. Now, the focus of relief aid will switch from treating the wounded to a rebuilding of the crumbled capital there. Where do they begin, and can it be better than ever, as some people say that it may be? We're joined by Ed Pilkington. He's the New York correspondent for The Guardian, just returned from a week in Haiti. And also Lawrence Vail joins us, a professor of urban design and planning at MIT. He's co-editor of the book, The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
So, Ed, you were talking about this exodus of hundreds of thousands of people, possibly from Port-au-Prince into the countryside. They're going in search of water, food, shelter. Does the countryside or the rural areas have that?
Yes. I mean, most Haitians who are living in Port-au-Prince have family back in the countryside. So, and there they'll find houses, they'll find maybe a small plot of land where they're growing their own food. They're self-sufficient. So maybe food will be a little bit scarce, but it's going to be much more plentiful than in the city. That's the sort of good news. It's sort of logical that they're returning to the countryside now. The bad news is that the people I spoke to, crowded around bus stops, piling onto these free government buses to go back to the country, are saying to us that within a month, 2 months at most, they're going to come back again. And there's a simple reason for that. There's no work in the countryside for them. There's nothing for them to do. They all came to the town in the first place over the last 20, 30 years in search of work. And that's what they're going to do again. So you've got a very small window, maybe 1-2 months, in which there's going to be a space within the city for repair workers to operate. But within a couple of months, they'll all be back again, and the city will be crowded again, and all the problems of overcrowding and piling in and trying to build shoddy, poorly built houses
the
will start up again.
The tent cities that we saw on hillsides and things. So Lawrence Vail, having heard what Ed Pilkington just said, can you kind of put that in perspective for us in terms of disasters? He said we have about 1 to 2 months. Is that enough time to get started on an effective rebuilding strategy?
Well, it's certainly enough time for individuals to get started on what they want to do in a desperate situation for themselves. In some ways, it's a false dichotomy to say there's a rescue period and then a rebuilding period, because the restoration that begins is part of what happens in between. And some of that will be very shoddy and very makeshift, and some of it will be just to get things moving again a bit.
But you've heard people saying, not just Haitian officials, but aid organizations as well, saying this is an opportunity to rebuild Port-au-Prince and rebuild Haiti better than ever. What kind of historical support does that have? Have we seen other cities recover from disasters like this better than before?
Well, first of all, the claim of disaster as opportunity is a kind of classic historic one. You heard it in San Francisco after 1906. We heard it after 9/11. We heard it after Katrina. There's a political necessity to say this. Most recently, the Haitian ambassador to the U.S. Has been repeatedly talking about silver linings, and one can hope that that's the case. There have been dramatic recoveries. Famously, in the U.S., both the Chicago fire in 1871 and the San Francisco earthquake and fires of 1906. Led to tremendous growth and development of those places. They're more relevant, perhaps, to Haiti. There's been some progress in Banda Aceh in Indonesia, a place where 170,000 people are estimated to have died after the Asian tsunami in 2004. 5 years later and several billion dollars of spending, I think most reports I hear are that things have begun to get better.
But Ed, in many of these places where recovery brings opportunity, as Lawrence was talking about, you need some kind of centralized, you know, in China after the government, you have a very centralized organization to get everything done. And in Haiti, the government isn't entirely stable or reliable.
Yeah, I hate to be the voice of doom, but I think all the factors coming together in Port-au-Prince are pretty awesome and pretty negative. I mean, you've got a government that is, at best, fairly non-existent, at worst, has a history of corruption. You've got an incredibly overcrowded city. This is a city with natural confines. It's got these very steep mountains on all sides, so it can't just naturally expand. It's designed for about 400,000 people, with 3 million people living there. And it's also, as we know, one of the poorest countries in the world. And you put all those things together, and I think, on top of that, I'd add, April comes the rains. By about June, you start the hurricane season. People are going to be desperate to get back indoors. And you put all these things together, and the recipe for people just building their own houses, just as they did before, out of breeze box and very thin cement, is going to be intense. And that's what happened last time, and we know what the results have been.
Lawrence, what do you think? Without a strong government to organize the recovery efforts, can they rebuild in a safe way?
This is pretty much a worst-case scenario, because as Ed is saying, some disasters have a great loss of property with relatively little loss of life. Some have great losses of life without completely devastated infrastructure. Some have both kinds of devastation but have strong political institutions that can direct recovery. And Haiti has none of that. It didn't have that before the disaster struck. So this is a huge challenge. And one can only hope that more parts will be rebuilt with reliable access to clean water and sanitation systems than existed before the earthquake. And one can hope that there will be more awareness of the dangers of building with unreinforced concrete. But the overwhelming needs of so many people who have been living with an informal economy and in an informal housing structure are beyond what anybody can direct.
Ed, what is the chances that we are in the midst of a recipe for repetition of disaster in Haiti?
I'd say extremely high. People are going to be piling back into the city. They've got about 4 months at most before hurricanes start hitting. And they're just going to be doing their own thing. They're used to working without any help, and that's what they're going to do again.
So it's more like Lagos in Port-au-Prince than some sort of futuristic, reimagined Haiti.
Yes.
That's a scary takeaway.
Yeah. Yes, or Nicaragua, where Somoza stole all the money.
Yeah. Ed Pilkington is the New York correspondent for The Guardian. He just returned on Friday from a week spent in Haiti. And Lawrence Vail is the professor of urban design and planning at MIT. He's also co-editor of the book, The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. Thanks to both of you. Let's check in now on top stories at 15 minutes past the hour.
Well, when President Obama takes the stage for his first State of the Union address, our partner, the New York Times, says he'll adopt a more populist tone. He'll be presenting a package of modest initiatives, including caps on some student loans and a new job creation bill. Meanwhile, the president's former top priority, or purported top priority, health care legislation, is in jeopardy following the GOP Senate win in Massachusetts. And over the weekend, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell told NBC News the bill needs a complete revamp.
What we really need to do is start over. I mean, the message in Massachusetts was absolutely clear. The exit polls that I looked at said 48% of the people in Massachusetts said they voted for the new senator over health care.
But the White House says the core elements of the plan remain popular.
The Pentagon will review the records of many Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who were discharged with post-traumatic stress disorder. They'll determine whether the veterans were wrongly denied benefits. That's after a judge's ruling in a class action lawsuit. And moving on to some pop culture anniversaries.
Hey, Celeste, listen to this. There you go.
This is your permission to crack open a cold one today to honor the 75th birthday of Canned Beer. A brewing company in New Jersey turned out the world's first beer can in 1935. Nowadays, most of beer drinkers choose cans over bottles. And one more. Bubble wrap. My son's favorite. It turns 50. The package cushioning was once envisioned as a new type of wallpaper. Now used to wrap fragile items that you've ordered from Amazon.com.
That's
a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're going to talk about people making life-changing decisions in this uncertain economy in our series, The Value.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts on news stories we're following this week, and it's time to start with the Fed. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is still waiting to be confirmed for his second term. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said yesterday the Obama administration expects Bernanke to stick around, and Gibbs warned of what might happen.
I think now would be a particularly bad time to send a signal to the international community and to our overall financial system by playing politics in any way with this upcoming vote.
Louise Story Jones is finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, you've told us, reassured us many times that you didn't think Ben Bernanke was going to face problems in his confirmation.
So we still don't know if he will face problems. You know, it's not like it's gone
it's
to vote.
It's been delayed.
It hasn't passed. But there is a lot of anxiety out there. It's very difficult to read why the vote is held up, because in the last couple weeks, the administration has shifted its tunes on a lot of its policies. So when you see the stock markets being incredibly turbulent, it's difficult to know if that's because people are afraid Bernanke will not be confirmed, or maybe it's because people are nervous about these new plans that the government has to tax the banks and to impose
populist rhetoric. Yeah.
Right. And so it's very difficult to separate out factors. And of course, we have coming up this Wednesday, the Fed will be making a statement on interest rates. And this Friday, we've got the fourth quarter GDP. So there's a lot of factors here at work. But one thing is certain. The White House is trying to make it clear that they think Bernanke has the vote. Sometimes that's a bit of a, you know, self-fulfilling attempt to push it that way. But all weekend long, they said he had enough votes. That followed reports last week about some senators like Boxer from California and Feingold officially pulling their support from Bernanke. So this is something that's very much in the move, and it would not be safe to say that he is in and it's done till you see the vote.
What do you think about Robert Gibbs' warnings that this is absolutely the worst thing, plain politics over his confirmation is the worst message we could send?
Well, there are people who think that. Of course, Robert Gibbs, you know, is speaking for the administration, and they would like Bernanke to be confirmed.
The markets hate uncertainty, of course. Which
they do.
Is
the markets hate uncertainty. So when this gets taken care of, it will be good.
Is there a cloud over Timothy Geithner at the Treasury? Where the financial channels were all over that last week. It sounds like buzz and speculation, but have you ever heard anything?
So Timothy Geithner was interviewed this weekend by Politico, and I was looking at that. And he was asked about Bernanke's future, and he said he thought Bernanke was safe. And then he was asked about his own future, and he said that he would be happy to continue help serving, you know, as long as the president wanted to make progress. So that's what he had to say, and I think the markets will be happy to see some of this get resolved.
One way or the other,
right.
The markets will be happy
right.
when it's resolved. Okay, Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks.
So our next takeout poses a real question. So how would we assess the values of a person with a rap sheet like this?
I've sold drugs. I've robbed people. I've actually been convicted of aggravated manslaughter, possession of weapons, multiple drug convictions.
Meet Duron McNair. He's a repeat felon who just got out of prison 8 months ago. And for our regular series, The Value, Takeaway correspondent Farai Chidea spoke with Duron about his job at the Newark Sanitation Department, where he's a refuse collector. And every day, this father of three balances the stability of going straight in a recession economy, even with a low-paying job, and his memories of that life of crime.
Were you living a more flossy life when you were selling drugs? I mean, was that what brought you into the game, or what was it that attracted you to selling drugs?
I believe it was the money and the lifestyle which came with it. It seemed attractive at the time because it was the here and now. I didn't base my life on, well, when my child turns 13, am I able, or are they going to be able to, you know, look back and say, okay, well, I know I got a good dad, or my dad's going to be there.
The value of a life of crime. In fact, McNair spent most of his adult life in prison. His most serious crime was committed when he was still a juvenile.
When I first was incarcerated, it was as a juvenile at the age of 12 years old. And that's when I had the aggravated manslaughter.
What happened?
Well, I was a young guy, and, you know, I grew up in the projects down Dayton Street here in Newark, and, you know, I had access to, you know, weapons and things like that because the people that I knew. And what I did, I grabbed a gun and accidentally shot someone, and I killed him.
That was then. This is now. Duran released from jail 8 months ago, seeking help from the Newark Comprehensive Center for Fathers, where he took a volunteer job, and then he got a full-time job at the sanitation department. His three kids will soon become four. Seeing the value of family, suddenly Duran now finds a purpose.
Well, financial security is definitely a blessing, especially with the economy as it is today. It's given me hope. It really gives me a sense of hope just to know that I could wake up in it every morning and I have a purpose. I have a purpose and I'm able to provide for my family and not be away, not doing things in which would send me away from them again.
Will he hold on to that purpose? You can hear more of Farai's interview with Duran and watch a video with Duran McNair at thetakeaway.org, where you can see all of the episodes of The Value. And if you want to suggest someone for Farai to interview, someone whose life is actually focused on this issue of where is the value in life, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org and we'll put her right on it.
You can also go to our website to let us know what your State of the Union is. All this week, we're examining the State of the Union with a variety of guests. So Doris Kearns Goodwin, General David Petraeus, Alan Mulally of Ford. What do you think?
Charlie in Harrington Park. Well, the president has spent his first year giving the American people the benefit of the doubt. It's time to stop waiting for us to get it. He has to stop herding cats and start herding the cattle.
What's the state of America and the task for our president? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or, like I said, you can post it at our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to check on the week's agenda with our friends Marcus Mabry of the New York Times and the BBC's Jonathan Marcus. That's coming in a few minutes.
Coming up, we check the full week's agenda, and it is full, with our friends Marcus Mabry from the New York Times and the BBC's Jonathan Marcus. More in just a few minutes. Right now, top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Haiti's Prime Minister are among the world leaders meeting in Montreal this morning to discuss the long-term reconstruction strategy for Haiti. Lawrence Cannon, the Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister, says it will take a unified effort to rebuild that country.
Together with the government of Haiti, we need to roll up our sleeves and begin to lay the groundwork for the enormous task ahead. We want to get it done right.
They have some resources. The international community has pledged more than $1 billion, and the organizers of that Friday night Hope for Haiti telethon say that event raised more than $57 million.
President Obama will use his first State of the Union address Wednesday night to recalibrate his message and reset his presidency after some recent setbacks. The New York Times is reporting the speech will focus on creating jobs, addressing the deficit, and helping middle-class families. President Obama will set the tone later this morning when he announces a series of economic initiatives aimed at helping struggling middle-class families. And we're asking our listeners to give us their own impressions. Can you describe the State of our Union in 6 words or less? Go to our website at thetakeaway.org. A check on the markets now. Asian and European markets down. Futures are up, though. The Dow will start at 10,172, the S&P at 1,091, and the NASDAQ opens at 2205. Those are some of the stories you're following this morning.
Hey, what's up, man?
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
What's going on?
Perspective. Well, after last week, the agenda for this week is going to be a doozy for the administration. It's solidly in Plan B mode after the events of last week, trying to push their way into a jobs message. The question is the ground moving under the administration's feet? Listen to Valerie Jarrett, senior White House advisor, talking about something we all thought was certain, Ben Bernanke's reconfirmation as Fed chairman.
President Obama checked in with the leadership over the weekend, and he heard from Senator Reid that there is a lot of support for Ben Bernanke. We are confident that the chairman will be confirmed.
Confident? Like they were about health care reform in the Senate? Well, Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times, joined us earlier in the studio this morning. And Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent, was with us from Bush House in London. It feels like the White House, Marcus, is scrambling to find a message with Obama going to Ohio to talk about jobs. Is the White House on the defensive?
Well, you know, this Obama is fundamentally, despite what the right wing says and what some conservative Republicans say, fundamentally a compromise politician. This is a guy who believes in the middle road. He believes actually not in kind of George W. Bush, which was my way or the highway. He came to office with a much greater mandate than George W. Bush, and yet governed not by saying you're going to do what I want. He actually listened to lots of different voices. That what we're going to see right now is a confrontation for Obama. Is he going to be about compromise still, or is he going to be about more my way or the highway?
Well, listen to David Axelrod, White House advisor, who may be getting a bigger role in sort of setting policy as the politicos gather around the president. Here he is talking on ABC News over the weekend.
The president will not walk away from the American people, will not hand them over to the tender mercies of health insurance companies who take advantage. He will not walk away from people with pre-existing conditions. He will not walk away from senior citizens.
Confident or defensive there, Marcus Mabry?
No, absolutely defensive. I mean, the president, you know, he's been talking a lot about fight, fight, fight. I mean, you hear him every speech he's been given since Scott Brown's election up in Massachusetts has been about how he's going to fight, fight, fight. It's going to be interesting to see two things to watch in the State of the Union on Wednesday. Number one is the tone. Is he going to take confrontation with the Republicans over compromise? And number two is his actions. Is he going to offer a whole smorgasbord of amuse-gueule, or is he actually going to offer a main course that's about job creation?
All right, Marcus. Is it going to sound like this?
I won't stop fighting for an economy where hard work is rewarded. I won't stop fighting to make sure there's accountability in our financial system. I'm not going to stop fighting until we have jobs for everybody.
So?
It's going to sound like that, but if you offer a whole, half the room will be applauding like that. If you offer the whole smorgasbord of little tiny programs about, you know, helping middle-class families save for retirement, helping middle-class families pay for child care, does that sound the same? Is that kind of gusto? I don't think it's going to.
Well, Jonathan, Marcus, forgive us. There was a lot on the table there in Washington, but it seems there's a bit of Plan B going on in the Afghanistan policy with Stanley McChrystal, the commander there, saying the Taliban will be brought in from the cold. What do you make of this, Jonathan, Marcus?
Well, it's a crowded week for Afghan diplomacy. I'm not quite sure that we have the term doozy over here. I think the Foreign Office would say it's a busy and sustained work week of diplomatic effort. Basically, there's a conference in Turkey.
Oh, they're so serious starting, over there.
Indeed, starting same language, different terminology, I suppose. But an important conference of regional partners starting in Turkey this week. That's a foretaste for the Afghan conference in London on Thursday. And, of course, I think what we're seeing now is, if you like, an effort to try and turn the coming weeks and months into a sort of a pivotal moment, a moment of change. On the one hand, a sense that the fighting is going to intensify. Sadly, casualties are going to intensify. But the other sense that there is actually no military solution. I think this was clear in General McChrystal's comments. There has to be a political solution. It has to be bringing some of the Taliban elements in from the cold. And the only way to do that is by military force, by a surge, proving to them that they cannot win on the battlefield. The problem, of course, is that President Obama has already announced a deadline, a time after which he hopes to draw down U.S. forces, and some in the Taliban may just decide to wait him out.
And there are no such options in Yemen, which is going to figure prominently at this Afghan conference in London. What's the situation there?
Well, the Yemen conference is the day before. It's a slightly shorter conference arranged at a much shorter timeline. Clearly, the concern is the growing instability and crisis in Yemen, the danger that the country could simply fail completely and provide the sort of haven for Al-Qaeda and other groups that Afghanistan did before 9/11. This is a country of extraordinary problems, one of the poorest country in the Middle East. Huge levels of illiteracy, poverty, lack of water, oil resources running out. And so this conference is intended both to stump up money, but more importantly, to really get down to the nitty-gritty and decide some key goals in terms of development that have to be achieved and achieved soon.
45 seconds here on the agenda. Jonathan, Marcus, take us out on what the Haitian cooperation on the recovery effort means.
Well, I think it has been a huge effort. The United States stepped up to the mark very quickly. The UN, of course, did so, but equally it has suffered calamity losses amongst its own people. The key question now is going forward, the long term.
Right.
What can the international community do to stabilize this country in the months and years ahead?
That was Jonathan Marcus from our partner, the BBC, on the future of Haiti, speaking to us from London. We spoke to Jonathan along with Marcus Mabry, international business editor of the New York Times, earlier today. Coming up, we talk about family life every Monday, and today we tackle a tough issue. How do we encourage victims of child sex abuse to come forward without further traumatizing them? More on this topic later on in the hour. So all this week, the State of the Union is on Wednesday. We want to invite you to deliver a State of the Union speech of your own. We're going to be looking at the whole set of issues for the Obama administration with all kinds of guests. Why don't you be one of them?
This is Michael Goldberg calling from St. Louis, Missouri, and my take is
that in America we have excessive vulnerability due to lack of manufacturing and export.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm D.E. Pockets, and I'm delighted to deliver the Corporate State of the Union Address this evening. I'm happy to report that profit outlook is strong. Merger and acquisition activity is at an all-time high, and regulation is non-existent. The president regrets that he couldn't be here this evening. We gave him a generous severance package. This is all. You can pick up your marching orders in the back. Thank you very much. And to those five Supreme Court justices, the check's in the mail.
Was it, Leo, was that like, was there any edit in there? Did he do that in one take?
Wow.
That was fantastic. What's the state of America and the state task for Obama? Tell us at 877-8MYTAKE or on our site, thetakeaway.org. Be creative. You know you can. Or in six words if you text us on the website.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And the name Osama bin Laden is certainly familiar. The voice, less so.
من أسامة إلى أوباما سلام على من اتبع الهدى.
That's the new audio message from Al-Qaeda's leader. It was on the website Al Jazeera over the weekend. The head of Al-Qaeda says the United States will not dream of enjoying safety until we live in it in reality in Palestine. That was one point of the message. The Al-Qaeda leader also claimed responsibility for that Christmas Day bombing attempt and warned the United States of more attacks. Here to react to this tape, and of course it's not completely clear at this point if it's authentic, Bruce Rydell is a former CIA officer and advisor to the White House on terrorism and security. He's at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning.
So let's break down the three elements. Number one, Osama bin Laden can claim responsibility for that Christmas Day bombing attempt, but were there any clues in this tape that he actually had prior knowledge?
No, there weren't. I think what he's doing in this tape is vintage bin Laden. He's taking advantage of an attack carried out by one of his franchises, the franchise in Yemen, to send a broader message that more such attacks are coming until America abandons Israel. That's vintage bin Laden.
It's also vintage bin Laden, we're told anyway, that there would be coded language possibly in a tape, but even this brief of a tape, and it is one of the briefest, that might encourage or trigger operations to move forward, maybe not actually execute them, but to move to the next stage. What's your thought on that?
Well, this is certainly a message to all of Al-Qaeda's cells around the world, throughout the Muslim world, from Mauritania to Indonesia, to try to replicate the Yemen attack. In that sense, it's an encouragement to others to do the same, and it's a kind of a lowering of the bar. Instead of trying to create another 9/11-style attack, a real mass casualty attack of horrendous proportions, bin Laden saying, it's okay to do something less than that. The important thing is to strike at the Americans now.
And in a story this morning in our partner, the New York Times, bylined Scott Shane, you suggest that that entire Christmas Day bombing attempt was possibly a tryout for a new tactic we might see more of. Explain.
Well, if you look at this attack, the individual involved, the Nigerian, was not a really well-trained operator. He was something of an amateur. He was a throwaway to that extent. I think they were trying out a new bomb. They were trying out new technology. It didn't work as well as they wanted it to, but they've now had a test case, and I think prudence alone would dictate that we should assume more such attacks will come in the future.
But isn't the counter-argument there that once you do something like that, the countermeasures almost ensure that you can't carry out that same tactic again?
It depends on how they develop the bomb. The bomb maker who made this bomb and has made previous bombs seems to be very agile and inventive, and I think that prudence, again, dictates that we take extraordinary measures.
Now, prudence suggests that this is probably Osama bin Laden's voice, but is there confirmation of that before we go?
I don't think there's any reason to believe this is not bin Laden. We've been hearing these voices now for 8 years. What's remarkable is despite the largest manhunt in human history, this man continues to operate out there.
All right, Bruce Rydell, former CIA officer, advisor to the White House on terrorism and security, joining us from the Brookings Institution in Washington. Thanks so much, Bruce.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. And coming up during our family discussion today, we're going to tackle a pretty controversial issue. Sexual abuse of children. What causes psychological damage? after that occurs. We're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. President Obama will use his first State of the Union address on Wednesday night to refocus his presidency after some recent setbacks. The New York Times says the speech will focus on creating jobs, addressing the deficit, and helping middle-class families. This morning, the president will gear up with a meeting of the White House Middle Class Task Force. He's expected to roll out several initiatives like limits on some student loans and expanded tax credits that are designed to relieve struggling families. Moving overseas, in Afghanistan, an official says parliamentary elections originally scheduled for the end of May will be postponed until mid-September. An official says the elections will be delayed because the Independent Election Commission does not have enough money to pay for the vote. And in Iraq, police say at least 11 people have been killed in three blasts in a hotel district in downtown Baghdad.
Moving to business now, Walmart is cutting over 11,000 jobs at Sam's Club warehouses. Walmart, of course, is one of the largest employers in the world. And you've seen the headlines in the UK, bank bonuses possibly subject to a 50% tax. Well, to head off some of those aggressive approaches to bank bonuses in the UK, Goldman Sachs has its own plan. Partners who are based in that country will have their salaries and bonuses capped at £1 million, about $1.5 million. Even though bank executives working below partner level can earn much more than that. Rodney Smith, business reporter for our partner, the BBC, joined us earlier with the story. I asked Rodney, can the UK officials make their aggressive bonus approach stick?
Well, I don't know about making it stick, but when you consider it from Goldman Sachs' point of view, what they see is legislation happening around the world, or specifically in the UK and the US, and they've decided to bite the bullet in the UK and reduce the bonuses, but only to those who are, so to speak, the most responsible of their people, that is, their partners. It means that traders and so on will be able to, probably able to earn significant bonuses over that. Don't fool yourself. The London partners are taking a big hit. In the past, some of these people have taken as much as $160 million home at the end of a year, and they won't be doing that this year.
Now, is there a way for banks to kind of wink and nod and say, okay, this year you'll take a little hit, but in 3 years we'll give you back your $500 million? And is there anything that UK authorities can do about that politically?
Well, in practical fact, that's what the UK authorities are demanding. They're saying several of the banks here that they must actually look at the future that way, that they're going to have to spin the bonus payments out over a much longer period. Some banks, of course, are grasping this nettle and saying, well, what we'll do is we'll actually pay some of the bonuses in shares. That's fine as far as it goes, but if you're talking about large sums in shares, sooner or later, that's going to come up against some sort of opposition from shareholder groups who will not want to see their stock diluted.
That was Rodney Smith, business reporter for our partner, the BBC. We spoke to him earlier this morning about bank bonuses. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
It's Monday, and on The Takeaway, that means we talk about family today. And today we're talking about a controversial and relatively ugly subject, child sexual abuse. There's conservative estimates out there that say 1 in 5 women and 1 in 10 men in America has been sexually abused as a child, usually by a trusted family member or a family friend. It's also estimated that 95% of victims never seek treatment or report the crime. That's why those estimates are conservative. Dr. Susan Clancy believes there's a way to get more victims to seek help, and that's by changing the way we talk about abuse. She's written a new book called The Trauma Myth, and she joins us from our studios in Boston. We're also joined by Dr. Marilyn Koitra, a professor of psychiatry at NYU, also author of Treating Survivors of Childhood Abuse. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Susan,
good
morning. Two things you established pretty immediately in your book. One, sexual abuse of children is distressingly common, and two, it always damages the victim. But where you break away from established psychological tradition is in the cause of the psychological damage. Explain.
That's correct. First of all, I want to make clear, I didn't say it always damages the victims. I said that it is a risk factor for all sorts of adult psychological problems. So in most cases, it's damaging, but not always. There are some victims that emerge relatively unscathed. But the main point I was trying to make is that what I think, or what the research seems to suggest, is damaging many of these victims is not the actual event itself, but it is the meaning of the event for these people later on in life. What's damaging is what's happening in the aftermath, how they come to understand themselves and other people around them.
In other words, Marilyn Koitra, she's saying that it's not necessarily the trauma of the event, that for some of these victims, the event itself was not either violent or traumatic, but dealing with it later. What do you think about this theory?
Well, I agree that there are long-term negative effects for people who have experienced sexual abuse, and I think that's something we've just got to lay out right there for our audience, for every survivor out there. I think the issue of debate is what should we call this experience, and I am on the side that we should call it a trauma. Even by the most narrow definition of the word trauma in our formal diagnostic system, in the case of sexual abuse, what it really is a threat to the physical integrity of the person, independent of their reaction, right? And this definition helps survivors know what's happened to them, right? Childhood sexual abuse is an experience when an adult takes ownership of the child's body for purposes of their own. And I think we need a definition for survivors to understand what's happened to them, just the way we understand that it's a crime. It's a crime in 50 states. It's also psychologically a trauma to the person.
Susan, your book is based on interviews that you did with victims themselves who described sexual abuse that at the time that it occurred was not, as you say, traumatic.
Right. And I just want to address what Dr. Kloiter is saying. I completely understand the importance of calling this event a trauma from sort of the adult perspective. But the problem is that because of our positioning the event as trauma, but not clarifying details of the event, you end up with a lot of people out there who never report the sexual abuse to anyone and who themselves don't necessarily feel like they were victims because their understanding of the event was when it happened, it was not traumatic. So that's the danger of using a word like trauma. I think we end up overlooking and minimizing the experiences of a lot of people out there who were damaged by what happened, but they're damaged because when it happened, they didn't really understand what was going on and they trusted the perpetrator and they allowed the abuse to happen. And for that, they're paying a price of guilt and shame and isolation as adults.
Dr. Kloiter, you're shaking your head.
Well, I think we have to understand the difference between a reaction to an event, which really varies among trauma survivors, right? They can feel shame, guilt, confusion, fear, and the event itself, right? And
right.
It's really the event itself, I think, that we should focus on and define. And kids may not understand what's happening to them, and I think they don't. And adults who've had this experience also don't understand what's been happening to them. And we need to help, as psychologists, to educate people by giving it a name.
But is part of the takeaway here that there's a separate trauma associated with bringing the perpetrator to justice that might have an impact on the child in this particular case?
Yeah, I think that's part of the idea of trauma, right? Because it is a transgression of a person's basic ownership of their body, right? And once that's understood, right, when we have names for things for kids as well as for adults, we can be unified in an understanding.
But Susan Clancy, your proposition is that if we broaden the definition of it to include those who experienced sexual abuse but for whom it was not violent, that it may encourage them to come forward.
What I'm just trying to say is I understand what Dr. Kloiter means, but I'm just saying that the repercussions of this type of positioning is that you have most of the population of sexual abuse victims who aren't reporting their crimes, and most of them saying that they feel guilty and ashamed. And I don't think that the trauma conceptualization is helping them cope with this guilt and shame because it's kind of overlooking their own experiences.
Dr. Kloiter, I mean, how do we come away with 95% of people not reporting it? Is it possible that for some of them it's because it's not traumatic? They don't see the event itself as traumatic?
Right. I think we basically have to distinguish the reaction to the event versus the event. And people can have a wide range of reactions, including feeling okay about it. But that doesn't mean that it was okay. And I think if we label the event a trauma, that's a sort of core definition that people later on can say, oh, something bad did happen to me. If we label a robbery, say, of a woman who's been stolen from, she might like the person, she may not know that it's going on, but years later saying,
right,
that was a robbery.
That's Dr. Marilyn Kloutra. It's an interesting discussion. Kloutra is a professor of psychology at NYU, and Dr. Susan Clancy's book is called The Trauma Myth, The Truth About Sexual Abuse of Children and Its Aftermath. Thank you both for joining us. And you can give us your comments at our site, thetakeaway.org, where Dr. Kloutra says she'll be happy to answer them.
And we want to send out a special welcome to our expanded listening audience right here in New York City. Starting this week, we're on for 4 full hours every morning on our home station, flagship WNYC AM 820.
I'm Celeste Headley.
And I'm John Hockenberry. You're listening to The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.